The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. The ACOI Luncheon Lecture, Medicine for the Boards, is presented by Dr. Scott Spradlin.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and take off here. So the objectives here, of course, is to pass the boards, but we're going to look through some common tests, some medical ethics, some of the items that have been on past boards or fair to be on boards, preventative guidelines, review of some of the vaccinations, and then really we're going to spend some time going through an sundry of test questions. So, this first section is don't miss simple questions. So this will be a fast pass through. When you get a board question that's focused on which would be the next best test for, if you're looking at cranial bleeds, renal lithiasis, appendicitis or diverticulitis, it's going to be a CAT scan. For MRs, it's going to be looking at CNS diseases, avascular necrosis, aseptic necrosis, and spinal cord diseases. A number of these scans have been touched on this week a little bit, but I'm going to retouch on them again. When you've got a VQ scan, if you were to get a board question to say this person had a VQ scan and the FEV1 was greater than 800 cc's, are they okay to have a pneumonectomy? The answer is yes. That's a critical kind of touch point. Bone scans, always like to make sure that you realize that the negative scans did not rule out osteomyelitis. It's very sensitive in Paget's disease. It's the best screening for bone metastasis, and it's negative in multiple myeloma. IVPs are to evaluate obstruction. Remember, you use a CT to evaluate any anatomical concerns. Thyroid scan, Dr. Sutton touched on this, but remember it's going to be increased in Graves' disease, it's going to be decreased in thyroiditis. Pheochromocytomas, for some reason, although you may have never seen one or two in your entire career, love to make it to a board exam. The MIBG scan also loves to be there. Remember that it is going to be positive in 1 to 2 days, and that, you know, really that a lot of people use the CTs and the MRIs to evaluate for the pheochromocytoma, but the board exam always likes the MIBG scan. As distractors, as part of the board test, and I think Dr. Burke has kind of teed me up for this, one of the things that you must really think of as you're looking through the board exam are the distractor questions. You may know what the answer is, but the distractor can throw you off. One of the things is an alkaline phosphatase elevated or decreased. So remember that alkaline phosphatase is usually associated with about three, four things: bone, liver, intestine, and placenta. So in bone, it is late pregnancy, bone metastasis, Paget's disease, and osteomalacia. With the liver, it's a cholecystitis, a primary biliary cirrhosis, primary sclerosing cholangitis, or liver disease. Preoperative evaluation. We've touched on it a little bit today, but remember, here's some facts about preoperative evaluation I want you to kind of instill in your head. The mortality is about 0.3%. The most perioperative deaths usually occur within the 48 hours after the surgery. 35% of them occur in the operating room. About 10% of the deaths occur during anesthesia. Pulmonary is the most common perioperative complication. Remember, wind, water. Cardiac complications are the most common cause of perioperative death. And remember, perioperative MIs have a very high fatality rate. When you look at the pre-op evaluation around risk factors, which we're going to touch on in a minute, an average 40-year-old with no risk factors, the incidence of myocardial infarction in a surgery is about 1%. When you get up to greater than three risk factors, it's about 5%. So let's look at some of the things that we would evaluate in a surgical clearance. One is Metz and activity. Become familiar with at least these three areas of one Met, you know, really kind of low end, taking care of yourself, average ADLs, versus the greater than four Mets, which is a flight of stairs, more of short walk or run, and then greater than 10 Mets, which is really doing strenuous athletic activity. One of the critical things about physical activity is it's a factor that you can use, but in and of itself, data and literature has shown that that really doesn't matter in and of itself. So if you got a test question that said, this person has certain comorbidities, but you know they're healthier than normal and they run 5 or 10 miles a day, how would you stratify them? Don't get caught in that question. Functional status alone of METs is not a sole reason. So one of the things that the board exam likes to do is in a surgical clearance question is throw a procedure. So you need to know which ones are the low risk procedures, the intermediate risk, and the high risk. Certainly the high risk is going to come to you really quickly, right? We're talking aortic, valvular surgery, major vascular aorta, or peripheral vascular surgery. The intermediates are going to be the carotid endarterectomies, the intra-abdominal surgeries, the head and neck, and the low risk will be the endo procedures, the cataract surgery, and the breast surgeries. So kind of put a mental note in your mind to that stratification. There are some conditions which should be postponed until they're resolved, and there's other clinical risk factors that should be included in an assessment. Those are history of heart disease, history of heart failure, history of stroke, diabetes, or renal insufficiency. So for a board exam on the active cardiac conditions, you heard this morning, if someone's got active coronary disease, that's pretty straightforward. But for a board exam, they may say, person's getting ready to go for an intermediate surgery that had an MI 60 days ago. What should you do? And so when you look at the literature, we're going to try to have you push the fact that you're going to say that's okay or that's not okay. Essentially, recent myocardial infarction, less than 30, depending on which literature you look at, but within the 60-day window, and I think they would have to say something north of 60, because some of the literature says 30, some says 60, but essentially a short-term couple of months from an acute event is something you would want to postpone. Severe valvular diseases until you've done further work up with non-invasive echoes, et cetera. When you were looking at labs on a general low-risk surgery with really no other comorbidities that would drive you one way or another, such as if you were a diabetic, here's some facts to remember. You really don't need an hematocrit unless they're over 65 years of age or it's a moderate or significant blood loss surgery. Electrolytes are not necessary. ECGs, only for vascular procedures, major surgery, or cardiac diseases. The reason why they want to catch you on this is because you know exactly what happens when someone comes in for pre-op testing, right? They get all this stuff. So the thing is for purposes of the board, they want to make sure which ones of those are critical. PFTs, never do one of those unless there's respiratory issues, and a chest x-ray only if there's known respiratory or cardiac disease, or they're over the age of 50, that magical 50. So in summarizing this, remember preoperative risk is a combination of looking at three things: clinical risk, that coronary or medical risk, the functional status that we just talked about, it's a part of it, but it's not solely a driver. And the third is the risk of the surgery. Is it low, intermediate, or high? So patients with active conditions should not undergo elective surgery until that active condition's been treated. People with no clinical risk factors can proceed to surgery without any non-invasive cardiac testing. So the simple question is a 50-year-old guy with cataract surgery, what does he need to have done? They could have done it, but he has a family history of heart disease or something along those lines. That's where they're going to try to make sure that you hit that. I think it's a pretty simple, straightforward question. You should be able to get it right and move on quickly. Patients undergoing low-risk surgeries can proceed to surgery without any type of non-invasive testing, but individuals that have two clinical risk factors undergoing an intermediate risk procedure should be treated with perioperative beta blockers or consider non-invasive cardiac testing before the procedure. And those with three or more, remember I said they had a 5% rate, so it's much higher. Those with two or more, it's about 4.2%, should be managed similarly unless undergoing vascular surgery, in which case they should undergo non-invasive cardiac testing. Let's take a quick turn toward medical ethics. Beneficence is a term that we don't normally use on a regular basis. That's the duty to act in the best interest of the patient. Non-malfeasance is the duty to do no harm, respect the patient's autonomy, the duty to the patient to make free choices. One of the things that will critically be, you heard this morning, a distractor could be a multidisciplinary team to evaluate. One of the things that they're going to make sure in any question is that the patient's choices are being considered and that you're weighing that as a point in with your clinical. Justice, duty to treat all patients fairly. When it comes to CPR and DNR, a physician's responsibility is really threefold. One is whether or not that CPR would be futile, the preferences of the patient, and the expected quality of life if it was successful. Brain death depends state to state, but for purposes of a board exam, is that physicians may stop therapy if a person is considered clinically brain dead. Ethics committee review should be involved, and EEG is not required for this diagnosis. And organs can be donated without the patient's prior consent. So let's look at a question that could potentially be on there. A 55-year-old man is diagnosed with cancer. As his treating physician, you talk to him about treatment medically, but also discuss social needs and support he will need. He asks you not to tell his wife. What are your obligations? Ethically to that patient, he asks you to keep that to yourself. You have to honor that. But what if it was a different diagnosis? What if he had HIV? What if he had a sexually transmitted disease? You must report that. You must tell those individuals, you must have them screened, right? So let's look at some of the United States Preventative Task Force guidelines. These have a tendency to pop up on the board examinations from time to time. Some of these are getting old enough that I don't think they'll be pertinent, but we'll still touch on them very quickly. Breast cancer screening, remember, is every 1 to 2 years for women age 50 to 74. One of the things they like to influence sometimes is that the task force says there's insufficient evidence for breast self-exam, and that alone is not a factor, so we need mammography. Screening for cervical cancer is that anyone in the age of 21 to 65 should be screened every 3 years. Those that are between 30 and 65 should have cytology and HPV screening every 5 years. And that women with a normal cervical cancer screening with three and not at high risk do not need to have regular screening over the age of 65. Colorectal. Between the ages of 50 and 75, there should be a screening for both men and women for colorectal cancer. That would include either Cologuard, fecal occult blood, sigmoid, colonoscopy, but right now there is no evidence for virtual colonoscopy. Remember, those individuals over 85 the only time you could do colorectal screening is if there is a risk, but generally,
that 50 to that 75 to 85 is a window which is falling off. But those between 50 and 75 years of age need the screening. Ovarian cancer. If anywhere on a board someone asks you, you should do a CA-125, it better be a cancer question where the CA-125 was elevated and you're going to follow it for monitoring. For any purpose of screening, a CA-125 is not the answer. So, and that against it has been used for many years for routine screening. It is helpful for monitoring ovarian cancers if the CA-125 is elevated. But that's the only time. Screening for abdominal aortic aneurysm, you heard that this morning. Men age 65 to 75 who ever smoke should be screened for abdominal aortic aneurysm. If they find that you don't have one, then you're kind of done. There is a question on women. There are some guidelines that are out there, but the Preventive Task Force has not made that a recommendation. So therefore, for purposes of the board, I think you're safe that if they ask you about a female, the answer is no. Coronary heart disease. We just came out of the cardiology lecture. Normally, cardiology occurs much earlier in the sessions than this, so people, I revitalize it, but it's pretty straightforward. In an asymptomatic individual, screening for coronary artery disease is not appropriate. You should not be doing ECGs, exercise treadmills, electron beam computerized tomographies, or MRIs in someone that's asymptomatic with no risk factors. If there is a symptom or a family history, then they have increased risk. That's not what this is talking about. Okay? High blood pressure. You get it. This is the one I always smirk about, because I missed this one on my board exam about 20-some years ago, and so I never take it out of my slide presentation, because what do? We check someone's blood pressure every time they come into the office, right? So they said, how often should someone age 18 and older be checked for blood pressure every time they come in, right? That was not an answer. And so it was at least every 2 years. So just remember, if you get asked that question, I don't want you all to miss it. Screening for lipid disorders. Remember, men over the age of 35 and women over the age of 45 should be screened for lipids. That includes total cholesterol and LDL and HDL. The U.S. Preventive Task Force is kind of screening those individuals between 20 and 35 and for men, and women between 20 and 45 must have other risk factors. So if you get a board question where it said they have a family history of ApoB, or they have a family history of early heart disease or hyperlipidemia or familial hyperlipidemia, then it's going to be okay. If not, then that would not be an appropriate age for screening. Chlamydia. Anyone under the age of 24 should be being screened for chlamydia. Unfortunately, it's only 16.1% of the entire American population, and that is a public health issue. And this is a fair question for the board because it's not being done. So it seems straightforward. Anyone is sexually active. Hormonal therapy. This made the boards a few years ago. It seems to have fell off. You should never be using estrogen and progesterone for the prevention of chronic conditions in postmenopausal women. You should never be using unopposed estrogen in the prevention of postmenopausal symptoms. Screening for type 2 diabetes. Evidence is insufficient to routinely screen asymptomatic adults for type 2 diabetes. They do recommend screening for adults 40 to 70 years of age who are overweight or obese, or for certain ethnic and racial groups with a family history should also be screened. Remember, the fasting blood glucose greater than 126 necessitates diabetes, or a fasting 2-hour postprandial greater than 200. Screening for osteoporosis recommends that every woman age 65 or men over than 65 should be screened routinely for osteoporosis. And those that are younger should be screened only if they have increased risk. And that increased risk would have to be defined as either non-traumatic fracture, loss of height, family history, something along those lines. Aspirin. This is one that is, even, you know, as the literature's come out, and even after I did this slide, and there's been more come out on the use of aspirin. God, you know, thank goodness that aspirin was out, or it would probably be a Schedule I drug before the FDA got involved. But the critical piece here is aspirin should be used for cardiovascular and colorectal prevention in those between the ages of 50 and 59 who have a 10% or greater 10-year cardiovascular risk. There is, once you've got over the age of 59, the risk is almost as high for the side effects of aspirin than it is for its benefit. So it needs to be weighed very, very closely. And for those individuals under the age of 50, you could make a case between the 40 and 49, but really it's the 50 and 59 piece. Lung cancer. Any person that smoked who had a 30-pack year history of smoking should have a low-dose CT of the lungs that are between the ages of 55 and 80 to screen for potential lung abnormalities or precancerous lesions. And once that 15-year span is over since they've ceased smoking, then you can discontinue the screening lung scans. Genetic testing, precision medicine, is exploding. Tomorrow we'll spend 30 minutes talking about a lot of genetic evolution, but for purposes of BRCA 1 and BRCA 2, which I think are fair for the board examinations, the important thing is that those individuals, both men and women who have a family history of breast, ovarian, tubal, or peritoneal cancer should be screened. And if they are positive, they should have counseling. Carotid artery stenosis screening, I recommend, there is no recommendation from the United States Task Force on screening for asymptomatic carotid artery stenosis. Even though there's the bus that runs around in my community about every 3 months and charges somebody $75 to do that on them, and they're like, people line up for it, it's like a sale. Hepatitis C. Still fair for the boards. Most of the excitement has resolved in our clinical profession right now. But individuals that were born between the age of 1945 and 1965, those baby boomers, need to be screened one time for Hep C to find out if they need to be treated. As you know, the evolution was to treat everyone that had hepatitis C. That's changing and evolving. There's a whole lot of issues around it, but I think that making sure that you're doing that screening in your office is important. For the first-time takers, and this is not so much for the researchers, so you can put another piece of cake in or whatever you're all eating over there, a salad or whatever. Fair for the boards is know the difference between the live viruses and bacteria versus the dead viruses and the dead bacteria. So quick run through, MMR, oral polio, nasal flu, yellow fever, varicella, and rotavirus are all live viruses. The live bacteria are BCG. The dead viruses are polio, IPV, rabies, flu, hepatitis A, pertussis, and hepatitis B. The dead bacteria are cholera, H flu, pneumococcal, and meningococcal. So now we're going to run through some slides here. I've got 12:32, so I'm going to get you all out at 12:45. Saw some of these pictures the other day. I'm going to just nauseate you here for the next 15 minutes with some pictures because I really want you to see these. What we've got here is a person. See, aren't you proud of me? This pointer doesn't work, so I'm going to do this one. Here we go. We got a fundus exam. When we look at the eye, because everybody likes to try to find the diseases in the eye, we've got our disc. Well, except I'm not very smart here. We've got our disc here, and we have the blood vessels. But we've got some pretty prominent areas here, here, and here. What is this stuff right here? and you saw it because I goofed up. It's macular degeneration. It's important for you to be able to see that. So you're not going to have to differentiate between wet and dry, but, you know, that's a fair question. Given the population the internists take up, it's very, very important to catch that early and to treat it effectively, either with vitamins or possibly other treatment. Whenever you get the fundus pictures and it looks like there's a bright light like the sun's coming through, most of the time it's either an osis or an itis. So, I'm going to try to give you some quick runs through here. Here we've got one. You can just see the inflammation right through here and here. What do you think that is? It's CMV retinitis. Okay. Here we've got one. Notice another sunlight. This is classic toxoplasmosis. Here's one. You saw this one from Sutton the other day. Whenever you go to it, it's just like a chest x-ray. Don't look at the mask. Look at the other stuff and then go back to it because you'll miss it. So whenever they give you a picture, just go straight for your, go straight for your disc. Disc looks good. Blood vessel's not too bad. Oop, wait a minute. Here's hemorrhage here. What is this? Diabetic retinopathy. All right, here's one that you see this one. This is definitely one that's this is an eye field. You can kind of see this. It looks like crystals all around. The reason they like these is because it could give you a driver to a number of other counterpoints around a person that's having an acute vascular event. That's cholesterolosis. This is pretty classic here of a hemorrhage within the eye. You can see there's a whole lot of inflammation. That's a sickle cell retinopathy. Remember, to look into the eyes is to look into a person's brain and neurological system. This one's kind of classic. You look over here, you don't see the hemorrhages. You do see this. This is metastatic disease. Here's one that really, you look at the disc here, all at once you automatically see that the disc is obliterated. You've got pretty much a half field here of hemorrhage and a lot of fibrous look here. It looks a whole lot different than the diabetic retinopathy, and it looks even different than a high blood pressure, so it's a retinal vein occlusion. It's pretty classic of a retinal vein occlusion. Another thing on board exams is strabismuses and eyelids and eyes. One of the mnemonics I use is LR6SO43. You can use whatever you want, but remember the lateral rectus is covered by cranial nerve 6. The superior oblique is covered by 4, and all the rest of them are covered by cranial nerve 3. So if you get a question on an eye, you don't miss it. So let's touch a little bit about this, because I think this is kind of fair for the boards too. And this has just been all over the press and everything else recently, is dementia. We're over-diagnosing Alzheimer's, and the reason why is because we really got to start thinking about what is dementia. Dementia is a progressive deterioration of cognition. It can be insidious or chronic. 80% have been presumed Alzheimer's, but we know that's not the case. To a lesser extent, there's other types of multi-infarctional dementia, types of dementia, and evolving types of dementia, because every day, in fact, last week there's a dementia meeting, or it's coming up, I think it was last week at the Cleveland Clinic, where the Lewy body research has gone nuts, and it's a continued evolve, and the TPC proteins that are coming out are even going to get more delineation around dementia. But it's a common occurrence in Parkinson's. Depression can resemble dementia. It's important for us to do appropriate screening there, that the memory loss is a concern from family and friends, that you've actually done a mini mental exam, and that they do show a deficit there, and that their affect is normal. Because you can have dementia and depression, but you can also have depression alone, and that gone untreated is not going to help. But if you truly have dementia, there are some cholinesterases, whether it's Aricept, Exelon, or others, to be able to treat it. But it's a very critical point that we think about the other types of dementia. Lewy body is one that has really become more prevalent now. It's a progressive cognitive decline. It's where someone, you'll actually hear someone almost tell you the story when you're talking to one of your colleagues. They'll talk about, well, you know, my mom was fine. She was living by herself, and they found her going the wrong way. And then all at once, the next thing you hear is they'll say she's in a nursing home, and she's completely just not talking or completely in a matter of months. That is a classic Lewy bodies where they have advancement hallucinations, Parkinson-type symptoms, and sleep disturbances. PICS is another one where you just have that rapid decline, the apathy, the disinhibition, the emotional disturbances, and it's really important to differentiate that from an Alzheimer's, because advanced Alzheimer's can give you very similar symptoms, but not initially. The CT and MRIs go so frontal and temporal atrophy, and there's really no definitive treatment for PICS. So let's look at a board question. 19-year-old presents with a two-day history of cough, runny nose, headache, and congestion. Got a low-grade fever at 99. There's some nasal mucosa is red, yellowish, secretions, and the lungs are coarse but clear with cough. What's the next best course of action? They're going to make sure that we're not, looking at the treatment, and that's what some of these subsequent slides that I'm going to talk to you about, is don't go for the zebra or the most intense treatment because you think they're pushing you there. In this question, they're really leading you to look for mucolytics and acetaminophen. You really don't want to go after that chest radiograph, don't want to go after that macrolide unless we have a reason or any other antibiotics. One of the things that would be fair for the board exam is for you to, if you have a person that has COPD that has an active virus, adenovirus, you got to be very careful about the mucolytics. The mucolytics can actually exacerbate an exacerbation of the COPD. So you actually might even back off of the mucolytics on someone that's really bad so you don't get an obstructive hypoxia. 66-year-old comes in for annual visit. She's got hypertension. She's had a total hysterectomy. She's on some high blood pressure medications, and she has no known allergy. She's 60 years old. What should we do? Regarding a pap smear, she's over 60 and has no need for a pap smear. She's post-hysterectomy and doesn't need a pap smear. She needs a pap smear with HPV. She does not need a pap smear because she's over 60, and I don't have the surgery report to confirm. The answer is the key word here is 65 for the test, so she's post-hysterectomy and doesn't need a pap smear. Board question, 32-year-old with a history of intermittent back pain presents with left leg pain, starts in lower back and buttocks and radiates down the left leg into the foot. He says it's worse at night. He's very healthy. He's an amateur bicycle rider. His exam is completely normal, except he has some moderate tenderness in the left buttocks area. It's difficult for the patient to tiptoe on his left foot. The rest of the neurological exam and deep tendon reflexes are normal. Which one is it, L5-S1, sciatica, or a peroneal nerve? It's sciatica. The key thing with that is there's no deep tendon reflexes abnormality, so if it was a DTR, then you would go to an L4, L5 possibly. Peroneal, remember, is inversion and eversion of the foot, and S1 is all about the tip of your toes, not your heel. Next one is a 34-year-old moderately obese female presents with an episode of blindness in her left eye. Lasted approximately 5 hours. She had an episode of where she's had some dimming of vision in her left eye. The pupil on exam, the pupil does not constrict when light is shown directly or in her eye through consensual response. Otherwise, it's a normal exam. What is the diagnosis? It's optic neuritis. And if the pupil exam light did not reacted but didn't accommodate, that would be Argyle Robinson, right? All right, question number three. 42-year-old who is homeless and chronic alcoholics brought in through the emergency room. He's got imbalance, decrease in mental status. Physical exam's flat affect. He's poor cognition. He has some ocular palsy of the sixth cranial nerve. What is the most common cause of this patient's problem? Wernicke's encephalopathy. You've been consulted on a case involving a previously healthy 34-year-old woman who presents with complaints of weakness in her upper arms. She says that her symptoms started 2 months ago. She's a waitress and has noticed it's been especially difficult to put glasses up in the cabinets. Physical exam, you see some tenderness of the upper arms and thighs. You have mild decreased biceps, triceps, and deltoid strength. It is difficult to tell whether the strength extinguishes when repeated because the patient's non-compliant. Lab shows a CK of 300 and a SED rate of 60. What do you think the next best step is? Well, the erdophonium is for myasthenia, so we don't think she has myasthenia because they would have had to talk about an eyelid. Prednisone, do we really know what we're treating? We got something inflammatory here. It might be a good point, but not necessarily at this point. ANARA, does it really sound like? We got to go down that path. Really, the right answer is muscle biopsy be the first thing, because we have a true myopathy there. Next one, 65-year-old is brought in by her family for evaluation of abnormal gait, increased falling, and decreased mental status. She's had extreme difficulty navigating the stairs. She's been more forgetful than normal in the last 3 to 6 months. She is otherwise good health. On exam, you examine her and find she's an elderly woman with a flat affect and masked facies. She has tenderness in her neck. Her neck is mildly hyperextended, and she has trouble looking down voluntarily. Her gait is slowed, and there's no tremors. Which of the following would you think is the most likely diagnosis for this patient? Is it Shidragger's, Parkinson's, progressive supranuclear palsy, or autonomic dysfunction? And then what do you think is the best treatment? Got to throw one of those in because you know it's a cascade effect if you get the wrong one, right? This is progressive supranuclear palsy, and the reason why that is because they got the vertical ophthalmoplegia. She can't look up and down, so that's the giveaway on that question. So that was the key point that would drive you based on the information that they have here. Remember, Parkinson's disease, they would have to talk about cogwheeling. We'll talk about that more extensively tomorrow. And remember, Shidragger's is nothing more than Parkinson's disease with an autonomic dysfunction. So all we did was break that out in there. So that's how you break that distractor out. Next one's got a 62-year-old with a history of hypertension with a history of heart fluttering, was brought into the emergency room with acute mental status change. You've been called to evaluate. She's not oriented to person, place, or time. Her blood pressure is about 189 over 80. Heart is irregular at a rate of 103. Neurologically, she's flaccid on the left upper extremity and left lower extremity with a positive Babinski. She has a conjugate gaze to the right and is aphasic. And you have the image. So we'll go do a lot more on images tomorrow, but as you can see, we've got an image here of the whole middle cerebral area here. So it's pretty diffuse. So this is really a right ischemic stroke. It's probably middle cerebral artery, main trunk. I'd say she's in atrial fibrillation, which is what we got. We heard the risk factor from the cardiologist, and that's the middle cerebrum that's involved. So we have a 50-year-old with no medical history, presents with weakness and fatigue. He has no other symptoms, and he has slowly got worse over the past few months. He's heading, you note on exam, he's got fasciculations in his arm and his legs, and lower extremity weakness greater proximally than distally. His deep tendon reflexes are brisk and actually hyper at plus 3/4, and his CK is 400. What's the diagnosis? Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. You get an elevated CK, you got fasciculations, and weakness, that's going to be where that board question is hitting you. It's the most common anterior horn disease. So, I'll give you three. I'm sorry, I went over just a little bit. I got 3 minutes. Let me go through these really quick. I wanted you to look at some of these real quick because these are things sometimes we get we don't know. You get an X-ray here. What do you see as the abnormality here? This is a complete atlanto-occipital dislocation. Don't miss common things that could be driving into this. And the answers are on here. This one is just classic of a... This is a cholesterol embolism. I wanted you to see what that looks like. You can see where that embolism is right there and that whole ischemia. This is one that you got to make sure there's other things that happen to legs other than DVTs. This is classic lipodystrophy from insulin injections. So don't get that confused with, and in these questions here, there's definitely no rashes or anything along those lines, but be very careful we're not getting confused with a DVT. Same thing here, this is lipodystrophy. That dorsal hump is kind of a pathognomonic for lipodystrophy. Very, very important component here. This is one that I want you to see. For some of you in the room, this was actually a test that was done at one time. For those that are my age, you all know what this is. This was a technetium 99 scan. What this was is this individual presented with abdominal pain and how Jolly Bollies were present on the peripheral smear. That is the this is the liver. And there should be a spleen over here, but it's not. But down here it is, and what you have is a torsed spleen, and that's why you have the hollow Jolly Bollies. Pelvic spleen. This right here is an individual, that patient with rheumatoid arthritis who presented with several months history of pain in the left calf. It could be a DVT, but since there's no, and you got this picture, you see no redness or swelling, but you do see a little bit of puffiness there. That is probably a Baker cyst, very common in rheumatoid arthritis. Can resemble thrombophlebitis. Here's one that's pretty classic here. Go to the disc, completely obliterated. You've got cotton wool spots. You've got hemorrhages. This is malignant hypertension. Here's a physical findings. Someone throws this CAT scan down to you and says, what kind of symptoms would we expect here? You look down through here. You look to the left. Right here's where it is. What do you think that is? That's internal capsule, right? Because this would be the whole middle cerebrum. But the thing with internal capsule is they have the same symptoms same symptoms of a middle cerebral infarct. So this person would have left hemiparesis and gaze deviated to the right. What is this? Is this a melanoma? No. And this is one I gave as an example because you go down and say, Loa, I don't know what that is. I don't know. I know it's probably not osteogenesis imperfecta, but could this be hemorrhagic episcleritis? No, this is a traumatic bleb. If a person comes in with something that's asymptomatic, don't go after something that you say, well, I don't know what that is. That's Loa's disease. This is a pretty classic traumatic bleb. Here's one that's very important. It comes, what are the signs you would expect in this 76-year-old woman with a history of anemia? And when you look up here, really the abnormality we see here is with the spine. It's really right between the C2 to C5 area here. And remember, it's a 76-year-old with anemia. So what would you expect? Romberg sign. This lady has pernicious anemia. Okay, here is a columboma. This one is, what would you expect from this patient here? We look down through our CT, right here is where it's at. Remember, when you see white, it's either going to be bone or blood, and since it's not attached to the skull, this is probably going to be blood, and you would expect this to be down at the level of the cerebellum. That is going to be quadriplegia because that's going to be a pontine infarct, hemorrhage. Here is classic hematoma of a subdural. Remember, it's going to have that concave approach epidural hematoma. The subdural hematoma is going to be pushed the other way, right? Here's one that a person, a chronic alcoholic, comes in with this MRI with horizontal nystagmus and dysarthria, and what you find here is a really enlarged pons. and there's actually a lesion right there inside the pons. And so this person has central pontine myelinolysis. We'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. Here is a photograph of an eye, and it's actually a corneal photograph. The important thing I want you to recognize in here is that's herpes simplex. That's herpes simplex of the eye. And what would we demonstrate here, the visual disturbance? The thing on here is because I want you to look, you can see the disc, you look at the blood vessels, you go, ooh, wait a minute, right here. What do we have? We have occlusion there. So we're going, you look down through here and say, is it temporal? No. Is it uniocular? Is it macular sparing? Is it a peripheral ring scotoma? No. You're not going to see that inside of a retinal field. It's an inferior hemifield loss from that vessel being blocked. And this is a hyphema. This is definitely another good example of malignant hypertension. You've got definite edema around the disc, you've got your cotton wool spots, and you've got your hemorrhage. And you can see the edema around here. And let's see, I promise. Oh, the last one here I want to show you is, of all the eye pictures, we've been through all the diagnoses, you've seen cholesterol, this is triglyceride. That creamy visualization of that triglyceride level going through, this is classic hypertriglyceridemia. And I'll call it quits on that one.